Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, listeners, we are soon to be appearing at New York Comic Con as part of New York Comic Con Presents, their evening programming. We are going to do an episode about the creation of what is usually credited as the first comic book, and we'll be talking about the man who did it and how that came to be. And if you want to get in on that, we would love to see you for our live show. It is taking place on October 6th from 9:30 to 11 at the Hudson Mercantile. Again, that runs during New York Comic Con. And for more information on it, you can visit our website, MistInHistory.com. You will click on the link that says live shows and you can get all the info and a link to order your tickets. We hope to see you there.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
So, Holly, you know how sometimes when something terrible is happening that we just can't look away from, we say it's like watching a train wreck?
Yes.
Yes. Although people do describe actual catastrophes as train wrecks, a lot of the times it's something a lot less tangible with way less risk of injury or death, like bad speeches or product launches that go really terribly or like really cringeworthy TV shows, things that are not really ready, you know, things that are not really going to cause somebody to actually die, we describe as like watching a train wreck. And I always thought that was kind of weird that we would describe something like, you know, somebody's bad talent show entry that's just awful that you just can't stop staring at, like why we would describe that as like watching a train wreck. It turns out that for a brief window from the late 1800s into the early 1900s, people in the United States were watching train wrecks for fun. It's hard to come up with an exact tally of how many of them there were because there were several different people who were arranging these things in different venues over the span of about 40 years. There were definitely at least 75 planned train wrecks to watch for fun, mostly playing out in the southwestern and midwestern United States, often at events like state fairs. So that's weird.
Here's what it reminds me of. What? So when my husband and I got married and we merged our households, we found that we had multiples of things. Uh-huh. And somehow in that deal, we had three microwaves. two which were pretty good and one which was really junky. So we gave the really good one away to somebody who needed one. And then the junky one we took out on the back patio and we blew stuff up in it. So I kind of understand this train wreck thing.
Well, when I was a kid, my elementary school had a Halloween carnival every year. And one of the things that they would do for this Halloween carnival is that they would go buy a really junky used car. And you could pay a dollar to get to take a swing at it with a baseball bat.
Yes.
It still seems weird, though. So it's what we're going to talk about today. I also, it's felt like we needed a little bit of a lighter topic. We've had some heavier things lately, some lighter stuff too. I, in particular, though, had researched some really heavy stuff. And I was like, let's just do something goofy. I will say this is mostly goofy. It does have a little bit of tragedy, but is overall weird and fun.
Yes. The concept of someone going, hey, let's stage some wrecks so we can all gawk at them. There is an inherent level of comedy there.
Yes. So we are going to start, though, with the one that did actually have a few fatalities.
This is the most famous and most deadly of the United States stage train wrecks, and it was known as the Crash at Crush, which took place in September of 1896. And this was the brainchild of William George Crush, passenger agent at the Missouri-Kansas-Texas Railroad Company, also known as the Katy, which was shortened down from its initials MKT. By 1895, the year before this event took place, the Katy had 133 locomotives and 163 cars.
William George Crush came up with this idea to try to drum up some publicity for the railroad and to sell tickets on the railroad. The railroad wasn't really in financial danger in any way, but the nation was just starting to come out of the panic of 1893, so the Katy was definitely interested in protecting its bottom line. The railroad was also in the process of replacing its 35-ton locomotives with 60-ton models, so Crush proposed they take two of those retired 35-ton locomotives and smash them together.
It really is just like my microwave. The venue that he proposed for this stage train wreck would be a pop-up town named Crush, located about 15 miles north of Waco and about 3 miles south of the town of West, conveniently close to the existing Waco-Dallas track. The designated spot was in a small valley with hills on three sides, making a natural amphitheater with plenty of viewing locations. They'd supplement this with things like a restaurant, a grandstand, and carnival attractions, selling $2 round-trip tickets on the Katy to get there and back.
The Katy had some concerns about the safety of this scheme, namely that the boilers of one or both of the locomotives might explode on impact, so they asked the opinions of several of the railroad's engineers, all but one of whom agreed that the risk of an explosion was low. So William Crush was given the go-ahead to proceed.
First, they laid track from the existing Waco-Dallas line, terminating at a 2,100-foot, that's 640-meter, depot platform, complete with a sign telling passengers that they had arrived at Crush. There was also a stretch of track for the two trains to travel down and crash into each other, which followed the natural slopes of the land. And this gave the track a slight downward grade from each end toward the middle, which would help the locomotives pick up more speed. Locomotives 999 and 1001 were chosen for the crash, with one painted green with red trim and the other painted red with green trim.
For their pop-up town, they drilled wells and installed spigots for fresh water along the spectator area. William Crush, which was apparently his fortuitous but actual real name, was friends with P.T. Barnum, so he borrowed a circus tent from Barnum to house a restaurant. They also constructed lemonade stands, two telegraph offices, a stand for reporters, and a bandstand. They built a wooden jail, which I found one source saying that that was made out of a caboose. They hired 200 constables to patrol on the day. And they also made plans for a huge carnival complete with games and medicine shows and a variety of other diversions.
Clearly, they were expecting this to be a party.
Yeah.
William Crush and the Katy advertised this spectacle heavily all through the summer of 1896, calling it the Monster Crash. The crash and the preparations for it became regular news items all throughout the Texas papers and outside the state as well. Organizers fielded queries from all over the country. And in the days leading up to the actual event, William Crush estimated that there would be 15,000 to 20,000 spectators.
William Crush had arranged for 33 trains to provide passenger service to Crush, and the Katy started dropping passengers off around dawn on September 15, 1896. By 10 a.m., there were at least 10,000 people already on the scene. They were picnicking and playing games and listening to political speeches while they waited. More trains kept arriving all through the morning and afternoon, some of them so crowded that people were riding on the roofs of the cars.
The Monster Crash was supposed to start at 4, but people were still arriving as that hour drew near. So they delayed the start until 5 p.m., at which point there were about 40,000 people there, double what William Crush had estimated.
First, the two locomotives came together very slowly on the track and touched their cow catchers together. That's that little great-looking thing on the front of a locomotive. They touched their cow catchers together, kind of like boxers touching their gloves before a match. Then they were reversed apart again, and William Crush, on horseback, raised a white hat into the air and whipped it down to give the signal for the wreck to officially begin.
The two locomotives, pulling empty boxcars that were festooned with advertisements and decorations, then began moving toward each other and picking up speed. Their engineers pulled their whistle cords and tied them down, then jumped clear and ran away from the track. They estimated that at the moment of impact, each locomotive was traveling at about 50 miles per hour.
When they crashed into each other, the collision was incredibly violent. The boxcars unsurprisingly shattered into splinters, but the locomotives didn't behave as they expected. Organizers had thought that they would basically push each other up into an inverted V, and they would expend most of that energy in the upward trajectory of doing that. Instead, it was more like squeezing an accordion or collapsing a telescope, and the two giant locomotives just folded into each other.
And then, to the surprise of everyone except perhaps that one dissenting engineer, both their boilers exploded. Scalding water and flying debris from the locomotives, including pieces of iron and steel of all shapes and sizes, flew into the crowd, most of whom were along the hills at least 200 yards away.
At least two people were killed, although some accounts say there were three. Ernest Darnell, who had climbed up a mesquite tree to watch, was hit with a 10-pound length of brake chain and was killed instantly. A young girl was hit with a chunk of iron that fractured her skull, and although she was reported to be resting comfortably afterward, she died on the way home. There was a third man, John Morrison, who survived the wreck itself but fell between train cars on the way home and was run over by the train and died. I haven't quite figured out if that is the third person some of the counts refer to as being killed or if that was a separate incident.
There were also a lot of injuries from the flying debris and boiling water, and at least six of those were serious, and some of them were sustained more than a mile away from the actual crash. J.C. Dean, a photographer from Waco, had been hired to take pictures of the event, and he lost an eye when a bolt from the wreck tore through it. His response was to get up and keep working, telling his brothers, who were also photographers, how to finish the shot that he had been framing.
Even in the midst of all this chaos and the tragedy that was unfolding, souvenir seekers rushed in to try to claim pieces of the wreck. Wrecker trains hauled off the biggest remaining pieces after the event was over.
People began to leave the temporary town of Crush as soon as the event had finished. Workers struck the tent and the other structures erected for the town, and the whole thing was essentially gone by nightfall.
William Crush was fired immediately. But then, officials at the Katy realized they'd had an incredibly profitable day in spite of the tragedy, so they hired him back the next day, and he worked at the railroad until his retirement in 1940.
The Katy began quickly and quietly settling lawsuits and paying compensation to the people who had been injured and the families of those who had been killed. Photographer J.C. Dean was paid $10,000 and given a lifetime pass on the train.
There wasn't nearly as much public condemnation as you might expect from an event that killed at least two spectators and injured many others, but the news reporting at the time was actually relatively pragmatic about it.
A few weeks after the crash at Crush, composer and pianist Scott Joplin published his Great Crush Collision March. Joplin would go on to be known as the King of Ragtime, whose other most famous pieces include Maple Leaf Rag and The Entertainer, which would become the theme music for the 1973 film The Sting, starring Paul Newman, Robert Redford, and Robert Shaw. It's unclear whether Joplin was actually at the crash, but the Great Crush Collision March was one of his earliest published pieces of music and a relatively early example of ragtime, which is a distinctly African-American form of music that was at the height of its popularity from the mid-1890s through the 19-teens. And we're going to link to that in the show notes so people can listen to it.
Scott Joplin is the reason I took piano lessons as a child.
Really?
Yes.
I love it.
And the part of me that wants to do an episode about him is at odds with the part of me that that does not like the sad aspect of the story, which is his death at a very early age from untreated syphilis. So the Katy went through waves of financial success and difficulty after this point until really starting to struggle along with the rest of the industry in the 1950s. It was ultimately bought by the Missouri Pacific Railroad Company in 1989.
There's a historic plaque commemorating the crash at Crush in McLennan County, 15 miles north of Waco.
Although the crash at Crush is the most famous of these staged wrecks, it wasn't actually the first one. And so we are going to talk about that first one and some others after a quick sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/Papertarian.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Really frequently, the crash at Crush is described as the first staged train wreck in the United States. It was something that drew a big crowd, but which no other actual railroad company tried again afterward for obvious reasons. But that September 15th, 1896 event was actually predated by one staged by a man named A.L. Streeter. He was a railway equipment salesman from Illinois.
Streeter first tried to stage a train wreck in Illinois, but wasn't able to generate enough attention. So he turned his attention to Ohio, where he got the okay to conduct a crash on July 20th, 1895, a couple of miles outside Canton.
Here's how he described it in one of the ads that he ran to promote this event. Quote, two monster locomotives with full head of steam starting a mile apart will rush toward each other at the rate of 60 or 70 miles an hour and allowed to come together with a crash that will result in the most horrible head-on collision ever seen or heard of.
Streeter made arrangements to buy a couple of retired locomotives and decorated them. One was emblazoned with free trade and the other with protection, symbolically pitting the two economic theories against one another. The two engines would pull flat cars loaded down with rocks.
Like the crash at Crush, part of Streeter's plan involved selling train tickets. A 15-cent fare on the Cleveland, Canton, and Southern Railroad would get people to the actual location for the crash. But once people got to that location, admission to the crash itself was not free. He hoped to sell 20,000 tickets at 75 cents a piece so that people could then watch the crash from a designated viewing area. However, the overwhelming majority of spectators had a different idea. That was to climb trees and to gather outside the official viewing area and watch it for free. So he only sold about 200 tickets.
In the end, though, these two locomotives never wrecked. The whole event was canceled at the last possible minute. Streeter claimed it was because spectators got too close and refused to move, ruining it for everyone else and forcing him to cancel for safety reasons. But the railroad claimed that Streeter owed them $2,400 for the retired locomotives, which he had never paid. So the railroad exercised their right to take them back.
Spectators, of course, were outraged, and the ones who had paid demanded a refund. People were also upset that they had spent that $15 train fare for something that didn't actually happen. Streeter was widely criticized in the press for wasting people's time and money, even as he claimed to have lost about $800 of his personal funds in the venture.
Streeter didn't give up, though. On Memorial Day, 1896, he tried again, this time in Buckeye Park in Marietta, Ohio, about 25 miles southeast of Columbus. The locomotives this time were named the A.L. Streeter and the W.H. Fisher. Fisher worked for the Columbus, Hocking, and Toledo Railroad. And to add some more drama, Streeter put mannequins aboard so it would actually look like there were people in there.
This time, the wreck did indeed go as planned. Clarence Metters wrote about the event in National Magazine, saying, quote, 25,000 pairs of eyes were riveted upon one engine or another as they rushed together, and so critical was the moment that scarcely a word was spoken. On and on sped the two iron monsters at the rate of over 40 miles an hour, and when the crash came, it was terrific, both trains being practically destroyed.
Streeter continued to organize more of these spectacles around the country until the early 20th century. But another man organized so many of them that it became part of his personal brand. And he was Joe Connolly, who was known by the nickname Head-On Connolly, who staged at least 73 wrecks between 1896 and 1932 and became the most famous organizer of planned train wrecks.
I found one account that said that he tried to sue someone for staging a train wreck and using the term head-on when that was clearly his. But I couldn't find any evidence that he had actually tried to register that trademark, so not sure what the actual status of that was. Regardless, though, Head-On Joe had worked in theater in Des Moines for decades before putting his hand to staging train wrecks, and he was scrupulous about safety. He had a very specific set of safety rules that had to be followed at any wreck he staged. He also told reporters that he had a, quote, lifelong desire to see such a disaster without danger to himself, and thought many other people harbored the same secret desire.
He was also a showman, and as his wrecks went on, he did things to make them more and more dramatic. He started laying small charges on the tracks that would explode when the trains rolled over them, creating tiny explosions that, in normal circumstances, were used to warn other trains of incoming traffic. He'd also douse the cars in fuel and fill them with flammable materials so that they would burn after impact.
Connolly made a lot of money staging these crashes over the years, and his last one took place as the fad was really starting to wane. This one was at the Iowa State Fair in 1932. He'd staged wrecks at the Iowa State Fair previously to a lot of fanfare, but in 1932, the United States was facing the Great Depression. Even naming one of the locomotives the Roosevelt and the other the Hoover wasn't enough to make the event sit right with the crowd. The explosion itself was reported to be a good one, but the response from the audience was really lackluster. It seemed like seeing two huge trains wrecked against each other for sport was needlessly wasteful in a time when so many people were hurting for money.
This was doubly true when word started to spread that Connolly had charged the fair $40,000 to stage the wreck, and that the fair had lost $65,000 that year. People who were already angry at the idea that the crash had been wasteful were furious that it had cost so much money, in addition to the wreckage of the locomotives themselves.
A.L. Streeter and Head-On Connolly weren't the only people organizing these staged wrecks. As another example, in September 1906, approximately 6,000 people paid to see two engines that had been retired from the Salt Lake Railroad crash together at an agricultural park near downtown Los Angeles. Organizers for this one were James Morley and former Pomona football coach Walter Hempel.
This particular wreck didn't go all that well. The engineers tried to extort extra pay from the organizers in the middle of the event. They were doing a prolonged run-up to the actual crash in which they'd run the trains at one another and then stop them before a collision. The engineers thought it would probably be impossible to find replacements in the literal middle of the event, so they asked for an extra $350. Organizers managed to find replacements with no problem, though. In general, engineers were pretty eager to volunteer, so the original engineers were fired and then the event proceeded as planned.
Yeah, the idea that you would get to just on purpose run a locomotive that was normally where you had to spend your working life into another locomotive and just smash it to pieces, like that apparently was attractive to a number of engineers. And I really didn't find any indication that any of them were seriously injured while doing this, although I did find one that was an engineer who fell while trying to jump free of the locomotive and sprained his ankle. So in this event at the agricultural park near downtown Los Angeles, the locomotives did run into each other, whistles blaring, but the end result was pretty anticlimactic because they just sort of whammed into each other with a thud and then stopped, and nothing derailed and nothing caught on fire and nothing exploded. And so people were not particularly impressed.
And these are just some examples. There were lots and lots of others. And there's actually footage of several of them on YouTube. We're going to link to that footage in the show notes.
Next, we're going to talk about some ideas about why maybe this caught on so well. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/Papertarian.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
So for roughly 30 or 40 years, staged train wrecks were a really big deal in the Midwestern and Southwestern parts of the United States. The biggest crowd reported at one of these events was 160,000 people, and attendance was routinely in the tens of thousands. The town of Crush had about the same population as Dallas or San Antonio for the few hours that it existed. In 1920, a staged wreck on opening day of the Minnesota State Fair doubled the fair's first day attendance from the year before. All of this happened at a time when getting somewhere was a lot less comfortable and convenient than it can be today.
This has led some people to speculate as to why this all caught on so well. One aspect was certainly the marketing. Organizers promoted their events heavily, getting lots of fanciful coverage in newspapers, and there was often a political theme to the decorations on the trains themselves. In addition to the ones that we talked about already earlier in this show, a staged wreck pitted locomotives dubbed Evolution and Fundamentalism after the Scopes trial in 1925. There was also a showdown between the National Recovery Act, part of the New Deal, versus Old Man Depression at the Minnesota State Fair in 1933.
And for some people, the attraction was related more to the general politics of the day than any specific political issue. There was a general idea that locomotives were symbols of big businesses and industries that were taking advantage of people and ruining the landscape, and so it was really fun to think about their destroying one another.
And then, of course, there is this fact that humanity has kind of a morbid fascination with destruction. There's a complicated set of emotional and psychological responses that feed into the general human trait of morbid curiosity. In the decades after staged train wrecks, there were demolition derbies, monster truck rallies, a whole slew of disaster films, true crime shows, and on and on. These are all still moneymakers in many cases.
Yep. Yep. I mean, I think the thing that strikes me as so weird about the train part is that locomotives are just so big.
Yeah.
They, like, that's a lot of metal smashing together and then doing, I don't know, sending it to the scrap heap or whatever, which, you know, made it seem a little odder to me than a demolition derby or a monster truck rally or whatever. But also, I mean, people did just do, as we have shown in our some past episodes of the show, people glom on to weird stuff sometimes.
What?
Which I think was also a factor. This is the kind of episode that happens when you're looking for something a little less heavy to write about and you Google weird fads.
Right. I've done similar things. yeah, it is. It's a... I'm trying to think if there would ever be like a modern day equivalent attempted. Like, would anybody ever go, let's try to crash planes together? I don't know how you would possibly orchestrate such a thing, but...
That sounds very scary.
Yes.
Well, and suddenly I just remembered when I was also a kid, in addition to having the elementary school Halloween carnivals where you could smash old cars with a baseball bat, whenever the fire department would be conducting training by burning down a derelict building and extinguishing the fire.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there would always be a crowd to watch that.
Oh, anytime there's a building demolished, there's a crowd. We had one in Atlanta not long ago, and everyone who lived in Atlanta had it all over their social media because they got up at an ungodly hour to go look at it. We like blowing
humans.
Stuff up. I don't know. I mean, I then feel very tame for, like, being like, what happens when you put a CD in a microwave? By the way, it's very pretty. Do you have some listener mail?
I do. I was in our Atlanta office recently, which is a treat whenever I get to do that. And I went through some of our incoming parcels. And so I have some thank yous to give out for that. First is Katie. Katie sent us Suffragitsu t-shirts. If you have not heard about Suffragitsu, basically in the 19-teens during the suffrage movement, a lot of women were studying jujitsu for self-defense purposes. And so these are t-shirts showing a suffragette defending herself, or depending on how you're looking at it, just throwing a police officer. So thank you for the Suffragitsu shirts. This is also from quite a while ago, after our episode on Walt Whitman. Kristen sent us an exhibition catalog called Bold, Cautious, True, Walt Whitman and American Art of the Civil War Era, which is a just lovely collection. And then lastly, thank you to Nancy for sending us the Naughty Fairies adult coloring book of bad words and worse attitudes. I was delighted to see a couple of copies of that in on my desk. So thanks to all three of you and to the other folks who have sent us various parcels that we try to keep a list and thank everybody. But I know sometimes we fail. So
usually that's my failure. Since I'm here and it all ends up on my desk, there are days when I'm just like, can't look at this. I'm so busy working on a thing. And then it gets pushed aside. And then there have been times, I'm sorry to admit this, listeners, where like which note goes to which parcel has gotten jumbled. And I'm like, oh, dear, mon dieu, I can't figure. Because sometimes they're obvious, like it will reference the gift. And other times it's just like, here's a thing that we thought you would love. And I'm like, I don't know which thing it is. So I apologize. That is my mediocre spatial organization skill.
We've also had a couple of things this year from listeners outside the United States run afoul of customs and be apparently tied up in customs for a really long time before getting to us. And then it becomes awkward.
Hey, remember that thing you mailed 8 months ago?
Yeah, we just got it. Thanks. So anyway, thank you so much to all of our generous listeners for sending us such lovely and thoughtful things. If you would like to write to us, we're at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/MissedInHistory and on Twitter at MissedInHistory. Our Tumblr, our Pinterest, our Instagram, all of these things on social media, we are at MissedInHistory. Our website, MissedInHistory.com, is where you will find a searchable archive of every episode we have ever done. You will also find show notes for all the episodes Holly and I have done together. We will link to several YouTube videos of locomotives smashing into each other in the player page for this particular episode, along with Scott Joplin's march that was about the crash at Crush. So you can do all that and a whole lot more at our website, which is missedinhistory.com.
more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.